This is Robert Stark. I am joined here with David Thressel. He runs the band Snog. David, great talking to you.
Thank you. Nice to talk to you, Robert.
And I'm joined here with my co-host, Pill Eater, and also Richard Wollstonecroft, who's been on the show a number of times. Richard, you put me in touch with David. Can you tell me about your personal connection to him?
Well, I'm not...
Careful now.
Be careful now, exactly. I have to be... No, I think I can publicly say this. David and I have been friends for about 25 years. We first got to know each other through my nightclub, the Hellfire Club. David was one of the original DJs of the Hellfire Club, along with Ollie Olsen and Andrew Hill. We struck up a friendship, we've been sort of friends since. David's done a lot of music for a lot of my films. I've done directed a few video clips for music tracks that he's done for his bands. But also, we're a couple of kind of troublemakers within the political scene. David is probably someone more of the left, maybe even the far left, and I'm somewhat obviously of the right, and maybe even of the far right. And but funnily enough, David and I have often,
yet strangely, we envelop the world and hold hands.
Exactly.
Between the far left and the far right, somehow, I don't know. We often talk about things, and David often has a Marxist perspective, and obviously we might differ on a few things. Probably David would be more easygoing about immigration than I would, but basically David's very clever, and he's also, through his band Snog, he's produced an amazing critique of capitalism that I think, you know, everyone should, on both sides of politics, should look into. David's band Snog, and also his musical instrumental act Black Lung, and this new act he's got going called Crisis Actor. So, you know, that's just something I recommend to everybody.
This sounds a lot like an
all-life
show.
You're too kind, Tricky
Dicky. David, can you tell us how you started with Snog? This was back in 88.
Yeah, well, look, it was a long, long time ago. I think music was an accident for me, actually. I was on course to be a visual artist. I was studying fine art, sculpture and printmaking, all these things. And then I woke up one day and decided that I hated going to, university or what you would call college. And I hated everything about it, actually. So I ran out of the building screaming and accidentally fell into music. And somehow that sort of moved along, and it kind of made sense, and it kind of worked. And Snog formed as a band the way I would think most real bands form. You know, they were just sort of friends knocking about, doing stuff, and I wanted to do things that I thought nobody else was doing, rightly or wrongly. I thought nobody else was doing this kind of combination of this kind of realistic observations of day-to-day life and the sort of larger political kind of atmosphere and this sort of electronic music thing. I mean, you can argue that that's unique or not unique, I don't really care, but what we did looked unique to me anyway.
I think it was unique. I think David first popped up on my radar, I think it was Triple J, which is like a big youth radio station, who I think he's subsequently been banned from due to his various troublemaking activities.
It's all true.
David was, he had a song called Corporate Slave and a couple of tracks off his first album, Lies Incorporated. That's what I first heard. And obviously when I started the Hellfire Club, I was really trying to find, when I did my club, I wanted to play the kind of music that I liked. So obviously Ollie Olsen was on my radar, and Ollie brought in Andrew Till, and then David was my other choice. And I was lucky to get both of them. And the three of them really hit. And the club was tremendously successful with those three DJs, and that's always been the best lineup of Hellfire, and just for about 5 years there, it just really kicked ass and clicked. And we also took them to Sydney, where they were having fun up there as well for a while.
What musicians were major influences on you? I know we recently interviewed NS from KMFDM, and their style is like electronic industrial.
Neither.
With that genre, and who were some of the musicians that were the biggest influence on you early on?
Yeah, look, partly, obviously, yes. I mean, I was, I've always been a mixture of kind of things. You know, I felt that what I was bringing to the table was a combination of this, especially in Snog, was a combination of this traditional kind of songwriting stuff for me personally, a lot of which actually came from country music, because I grew up in the country, which doesn't necessarily mean that you listen to country music, but I did hear a lot of country music, and my father played a lot of Johnny Cash and Tom T. Hall, and these, especially Tom T. Hall, who was, you know, was an incredible songwriter. So I heard a lot of these really interesting lyrics, and then later on, you know, I was listening to Tom Waits and these kind of people who had interesting kind of lyrics, and I wanted to make a hybrid of that kind of thing where there is a real focus on the lyrics, but plus with this electronic music thing, you know, I mean, I was hearing Frontufutu and these kind of things with musically, actually also lyrically, they're quite interesting at times, but musically it was very interesting. You know, much like Richard, I was also a big fan of Depeche Mode, you know, so there was definitely this history of this electronic based pop music.
Was there a scene out of Australia comparable to the sort of a UK 80s scene like Depeche Mode in England?
Look, Australia has had a sort of lots of subterranean scenes, many of which would not necessarily be known outside of Australia. But, I mean, Australia, certainly it had, you know, an industrial scene, which I think both myself and Richard would certainly have been aware of, you know. You know, it was not that hard to see SPK or Thug or the Dumb and the Ugly or all these sort of bands that had some connection to the history of industrial music. You know, they definitely had you know, deep connections in Australia. So there was definitely a history there of that kind of music, which wasn't hard to access at all, really. I mean, also Seven Heads is an obvious one, you know. So I think we were both somewhat in the shadow of that kind of music and liked that sort of music and also just felt a kinship with its sometimes sort of DIY and, you know, devil-may-care attitude, and it's the way it turned its back on the mainstream, I guess, is an important thing. You know, it's it wasn't beholden to pop music and the various fashions and bumps in the road of popular culture.
Did you notice the way recently that Richard Spencer declared Depeche Mode the official band?
Oh yeah,
they're going to be very uncomfortable with that, you know. The half of them living in California, they're going to be very uncomfortable with that. Their neighbours are going to be looking at poor Martin Gore, his neighbours, you know, they're not going to invite him around for coffee anymore, you know.
Well, that's what happens when you make a song about the revolution and you make an album Spirit and go back to that fascist trilogy along with Black Celebration and Music for the Masses, you know. There always was that alt-right undertone in their early releases and in the new Spirit album, you know.
I thought that new single was interestingly kind of ambivalent in its lyrical stance. I mean, I felt, I don't want to pay out on them because, you know, I actually love them as a band, you know, but I felt like listening to the lyric of that song, it could have been passed through some kind of research think tank or focus group because the lyric has this classic pop inclination to be all things to all people. You know, yes. People can attach their own political views or their own sort of political worldview to this reasonably ambivalent lyric.
Let's discuss that song. It's called Where's the Revolution? There are some clues. There's a lyric it calls The Train is Coming. The Train is... Now, that's the Trump train. Now, that only references one... The Trump train, right? The Trump train is coming. And it also says something about, you've been fed fake news. It says something along, you've been fed lies. And it also says you've been pissed on, you've been ignored. Basically, I think it is a Trump song, but they, like you say, they have disguised it. And also in the film clip, they dress up as Marx, and at one stage his suit appears red. So you know what I mean? It could have a left meaning as well. So, I mean, obviously, ambiguity, I'm always fond of ambiguity in art, so I don't blame them for even doing that. But I think secretly it is a Trump song. And there are a couple other hints in the lyrics too to that song, if you listen to it, that secretly reference the whole Trump phenomena. But maybe that's a revolution, or maybe he's more Marxist, or maybe he's like David and I, and, you know, we're not entirely sure what's going on at the moment. Everything's so crazy.
I think it's interesting, and I do think, you know, the lyric, I mean, it's not hard to identify, is it, that there is a great level of discontent in our, you know, populations. I mean, that's, you know, it's not exactly a great secret, is it? You know,
no,
it isn't. And the recent U.S. election, you know, from the distance of Australia, although I was in the U.S. for a couple of months last year, you know, it's an obvious sort of precipitation of discontent with the sort of political mainstream, you know. Martin Gore's tapping into that.
Tell us about your tour in the States, what you noticed on your recent tour, because you've told me this in person, and I think that's something that will be good to hear you tell the people.
Oh, absolutely. I was fascinated. You know, Richard certainly knows that I'm fascinated by all these sorts of things, you know. And we're in the States on a snog tour in April and May, I guess, of last year, you know, and that was kind of the height of your primary election season, you know, which is an interesting thing in itself, you know. And I did, because I'm a bit of a Luddite, you know, I don't have a phone or an iPhone or an iPad or any of these things. I tend to spend my time on the tour bus looking out the window and observing things, which I love to do as we travel around the States. And we did a big loop around the States. You know, we did about 24 or 25 shows or something like that. We did the big loop around the whole of the US.
Did you go from coast to coast?
Yes, we did. We went from coast to coast and then back again. So we started off in Seattle, went through the north, ended up in New York, and then came back through the south, back to Seattle. So, you know, we did a loop around the whole of the U.S., and I'm keenly watching, and I'm also keenly talking to people. You know, I would have spoken to thousands of people, really, around the whole of the U.S., you know, and Americans, if I may say so, as an outside observer, are different to Australians, as in that Americans tend to be much more upfront, tend to be much more proud of their politics, their political persuasion. So, and you wouldn't see this in Australia, but in the US, of course, I saw thousands of posters and placards on people's lawns and in their windows and in shop windows, et cetera, declaring their affiliation in the primaries, you know. And I kept a rough tally as we went around the US, you know, and I attempted to be as objective as I possibly could. My rough tally was around about 85% Sanders and about 15% Trump out of the 10,000-15,000 posters and placards that I might have seen around the US. And, you know, I observed, one of the observations that I took from that, I mean, I think the whole primaries, the Democratic primaries, were clearly completely rigged, but I didn't see one for Hillary Clinton, single one out of the 10 or 15,000.
Didn't she, David? I mean, you and I have had this conversation in private as well, but she seemed like a fake candidate of the globalist 1%. Like, she really had no support at all. And that even though I think she cheated tremendously, you know, voter fraud, I think she figured maybe 6 million votes or whatever the estimate is by some of the more generous critics, you know, she thought that was enough. But basically, it wasn't enough because, you know what I mean? I think no one liked her.
I met one person who I won't name. I met one person in the whole of the States who said they were voting for her. And it was very funny. To be frank, he was kind of a yuppie. And he said, I met him in Brooklyn in New York at a party. And he said, yes, he was going to vote for Hillary Clinton. He knew that it was going to be bad if she got in for most people. A lot of people would die if she came in. But he personally would make out really well out of it financially. So he was going to vote for her. That was the only person I met. I agree with Richard. I think she was a complete media and complete political establishment candidate. And, I mean, I think now, you know, as we've discussed in private, I think mainstream politics has actually become interesting in the last year or two. Because before then, it was just business as usual and the same old crap all the time, you know. But I think the establishment has really revealed itself in the last year. If you know, the only way you can not see that is if you're really not paying attention or if you're completely brainwashed.
Well, David, I mean, you preferred Sanders over Trump, but do you see Trump playing?
No, I didn't. I didn't say that. I never really looked into Sanders. And honestly, my view is, I think the terms left and right are actually basically kind of useless today. You know, they don't really have a connection to those what traditionally might have been called left and right. I think they are kind of misnomers. They're just not useful terms anymore. My personal view is that a better delineation, I guess, if you need to delineate people today politically, is the people who are statists and the people who are non-statists. And I would describe myself as a non-statist very strongly.
Do you see Trump as playing a role in dismantling or at least challenging the neoliberal power structure?
That is certainly the hope of a lot of people. I reserve cynicism about all these political machinations because I'm cynical about politics. We've been burnt so many times by so many offerings, utopian offerings from our broken political system. I would observe that, Trump has said some outrageous and amazing things against the political establishment. You know, I think it's yet to be seen if they can follow through on those, but simply calling out the mainstream media for being systemically dishonest is an amazing thing for a politician to do. And likewise, rejecting the TPP is the kind of thing that no other mainstream politician of the last 40 years has had the guts to do.
That's one thing I'd like to put to you, David. I mean, because I guess you would be considered, at least to some extent, a man of the left, at least among many of our friends and stuff. You know, what could you say to other leftists in the way that they could look at Trump in a way? Because, you know, obviously there's a part of the left that just can't stand him. But obviously there are other members of the left who are more Marxist, people like John Pilger, Julian Assange, many others, who at least see maybe, you know, he might be the devil we know, or, you know, maybe he has some interesting ideas in relation to TPP, in relation to anti-outsourcing, which keeps, you know, local jobs and protects the local working class. I'd just like to, you know, get your general opinion, you know, that, you know, maybe leftists who might listen to it on a podcast like this, you never know, it's a big world. You know, what would you say to these people?
Look, it's a long conversation. I mean, that question alone could fill hours of discussion, I think, you know. I mean, my personal view, I realize I get identified as being on the left, but, I'm uncomfortable with these left and right descriptions. I just don't think that they're accurate anymore, you know.
Yes.
But I do think that what presently calls itself the left has become an embarrassment. Certainly there's a disillusionment in the general population, which is not really recognized by the elites. It's not really recognized by the media. It's not really recognized by the professional classes and the information class. But there is a palpable discontent in the population with the political status quo and with the media and with the whole structure. I mean, this is obviously why Trump was elected, because he identified this and tapped into it. And I think it's interesting. I mean, I think it's really, really, really interesting that what's called the left now has basically sided with what has been called for quite a while the deep state. You know, the CIA, the NSA, these organs of the deep state. I mean, you know, that's an embarrassing coalition, that one. And I would really be reticent to ever be backing the CIA and the NSA on anything, ever.
And the left has completely abandoned a lot of their traditional issues like workers' rights, civil liberties, anti-war.
Look, I completely agree with you, and I think that's why these terms left and right have become kind of deceptive, really. I mean, because what's called the left now, I agree with you, it has no action on these traditional sort of left areas of discussion and action at all. I mean, you've just had 8 years of this sort of token leftist U.S. president that, you know, says a whole lot of nice things, and I'm sure Hillary Clinton would have been the same or even quite possibly much worse. They mouth all these sort of platitudes and these token statements about diversity and respect and blah, 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 blah. Meanwhile, they bomb their way around the planet and they are responsible for the deaths of hundreds of thousands, if not millions of people. I mean, it's surreal. It's madness. It's palpable madness, the whole thing, actually.
Absolutely. And oddly enough, it actually plays into a lot of what you've been saying with your music for the past 25 years. I mean, in the sense, the way you've spoken about your critique of capitalism becoming a kind of, you know, like, as I said, almost infecting the left, and to the point where what we've been saying, where the left and the white lose their actual definition. And really, I mean, my whole point when I speak to people is that, to me, the traditional left and the traditional right have the same enemy, which is the globalist 1%, which is like the plutocratic elite. You know what I mean? Essentially, we're both fighting against the pricks, and we might have different strategies about.
I completely agree. I think they're the enemy of humanity. I mean, in fact, you know, my position is, I think that the government really is the enemy of the people, not in theory, but certainly in practice, because government is usurped by those with the most wealth and power, and it becomes their instrument, and it certainly has. And that's also the case, and I would say equally the case, with the mainstream media, which simply become an instrument of the powerful. And I mean, if you can't see this, then you've honestly, you're kind of stupid.
And the thing with the media is people have been brainwashed so much. You see all these SJWs and anti-Trump protesters. I mean, they actually despise the alt-right more than they despise the globalist 1%.
Yeah, and I think a lot of this stuff is based on this sort of emotional programming. I mean, stepping back a few steps, it's a very interesting but quite nasty thing to observe. You know, we really are at a point in our society where there's no real room for rational debate or discussion between different points of view. That option has kind of vanished, and we just have emotional kind of, and I hate the word triggers, it's so overused, I hate it, but it's the most obvious one to use in this case. We just have all these emotional triggers, and so you've kind of got these, I mean, what passes for public discourse today is just this sort of infantile babies bashing their toys against the side of the pram. It you know, there's no, you know, people are, I mean, and I think the internet, you know, it brings good things to the table, obviously, but it also brings really bad things to the table. And I think one of the bad things it brings to the table is that people are in their corners, in their cubicles of the internet, shouting into this empty warehouse. And that's not discussion anymore, you know?
You focus a lot on issues of consumerism, globalization, economics, class issues, the police state. Can you talk about how you first became aware of these issues and how that led to influencing your music?
Look, I couldn't give you a definite moment in time or anything like that, I think. But yes, for a long time I've been aware of and concerned about, I mean, you can call it consumerism, but I think it goes a lot deeper than that. I don't really know what the best word for it is, you know, but humankind's kind of bred and hypnotized and brainwashed obsession with money and status and consumer items in this whole kind of treadmill. Yes, I've been very uncomfortable with this thing for a long time. While trying not to be a complete hypocrite, I also realized that that is in all of us. You know, that octopus has got its tentacles in all of us. You know, I don't live in the middle of the jungle with two rubber bands and some old coconuts that I rub together for dinner. You know, we're all part of this kind of beast. But that beast is, it's really controlling us to an extraordinary degree. And, years ago when I read, I noticed this before then, but when I read years ago the Unabomber Manifesto, you know, I found his whole tract, if it was him, I found that whole tract about technology and how that we have a blind side with technology and that we are the slave and technology is the master in that relationship. I found that fascinating, and every observation tends to bear that analysis out.
In my dissidence class at university, I basically had to defend that industrial society and its future and saying, hey, this is a really critical book, especially against what we know. Like, he drops the left all the time. He says, like, what we, you know, blatantly on the alt-right says cultural Marxism. I mean, I think Ted Kaczynski already knew this was happening, and he uses huge criticism against the left and industrial society in its future. And I think it's definitely one of those anarcho-green writings. I love the book.
It is fascinating. It's a fascinating book. And I think it's fascinating the way that he identified this combination, this amazing combination that we've been witnessed in our lifetimes, where people have been turned into sort of armchair activists, and they've been mobilized in directions that I in my view, I think they just don't understand, you know. Yeah, and I think that the media has really, really come to a position where it absolutely controls people and the way they behave and the way they react and the way they respond and the way they discourse.
Let me just make a comment on this whole, what's it called, the Unabomber Manifesto. I mean, and in a way it does tie into the whole alt-right. And basically that the Unabomber Manifesto is really based around an essay by Martin Heidegger called The Question Concerning Technology. It was written in the 1950s, post-war. And obviously, Heidegger is probably the founding member of the alt-right, really, probably, in a way, like, because obviously he was someone connected to fascism or whatever that continued the critique of capitalism, which he saw as basically a kind of implementation of nihilism at its most destructive. And it's interesting that that essay really tied in. And obviously, I think there was about 30 or 40 years difference between the Ted Kaczynski essay and Heidegger's. And obviously technology had gone exactly the way Heidegger had predicted. And that it's kind of weird that the way that politics, again, is headed back towards, you know, a kind of rightist, at least in a, you know, what was called the conservative revolution. I'm sure you know about this stuff, Richard Stark.
It's definitely a red pill. If anybody had the New Yorker, New York Times that day, everyone got the red pill from his magazine. You can't even find copies of it. Sometimes it appears on eBay, the original cut when it was released, but it's definitely
Red pill. Adam Parfrey released a whole bunch of the manifesto, so we should drop it. Adam Parfrey.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I love that.
Yeah, I mean, look, that's a thread, that whole, Heidegger's essay. I mean, there's a thread there that goes back to the Luddites. You know, and I know the Luddites have a bad reputation, but actually I identify with them and I sympathize with their point of view, you know, because technology, yes, of course, it brings wonders to us, but it always has a downside, you know, and I think there's a blind spot, there's a weakness in humankind that we can't identify those blind spots and we can't identify our own weaknesses when we interact with technology.
It completely controls our day-to-day lives. I mean, there's so many issues. Our whole like schedule functions around it, our economy, there's exactly. The privacy issues.
Well, exactly. And I mean, the question is, because technologies are owned now. They're owned. So, yes, the technology controls our schedule and our information flow and our workflow and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that technology is also owned itself. So somebody owns the information flow, and they own all these kind of fundamental aspects of our presence, the way our society is composed presently.
And this
is where they're all owned by people.
The question is kind of like, how do we deal with this? We could go into the extreme sort of Luddite example of people going out into the woods and living off of nature. Some people will do that, but I don't think it's practical for large numbers of people.
Well, Heidegger never meant that. He never meant for people to live in huts like the Unabomber. I mean, that was, for example, a misunderstanding of Heidegger's critique of technology. He said that, and this is the whole thing, we talk about the ownership of technology, which is, of course, true. Because
what I was going to say is, like, being able to, I mean, technology is inevitable. It's not going away, so, I mean, how do we use it, utilize it to our benefit?
There are ways to use it in ways.
You see people doing that with networking, with like-minded people. Then there's also people putting out ideas. You have these like monopolies of, say, social media censoring free speech, should the state play a role in stepping in and guaranteeing, say, free speech on a public platform like Twitter?
Well, I think so. I think something that, for example, if Trump complains about the media, I mean, why doesn't he nationalize some of it? I mean, they call him a fascist. Why doesn't he behave that way a little bit? You know what I mean? Like, I think it would be fantastic to nationalize the New York Times, to nationalize Twitter, to nationalize Facebook. I mean, think about it. Like, these
The theory is obviously that they're going to go broke anyway, you know.
Yes. Because well, the National New York Times. Because, you know, I mean, and that's one thing that's interesting about Trump, the way he is really, really stuck it to the media, and we brought that up before. But I think the interesting thing about, you know, this whole thing of technology is Trump called it the Gestell, which means, like, in framing. And you see this come out in popular culture with ideas like The Matrix and ideas that we live in. Like even a film like Koyaanisqatsi that sees us all as, like, little bits inside a kind of computer system that are all running around. And that even though people might own technology, and this is, again, Heidegger's point when Heidegger spoke about the Holocaust, he said that, the Jewish people basically exterminated themselves, and people always get upset by that comment. He doesn't understand what he meant by that. He said that the kind of mindset, the kind of materialist mindset that revolves around money, eventually leads to the destruction of human beings, and of which they at one time was also a part of. Obviously, it's led to the destruction of many human beings in genocides in Rwanda, in Cambodia, in what was the one that the Turks did with the Kurds, and on and on and on. It's just a list of horrors. There's one going on in the Congo at the moment. So, you know, it's like it's a way of looking at the world, and that even if you own the media, and this is what I think that the mainstream media have discovered, even though they own everything and they think they control it, they don't control it. Something outside of the system can still burst through. And I think that was what was interesting about Trump. Exactly how good he will be, I mean, obviously I'm probably more sympathetic. David might be a bit more skeptical, but, like, you know, I think we're both open to the idea that he might do something interesting, particularly the way he calls out the media, particularly the way that
I think calling out the media is fantastic. And I think it's interesting, and, you know, of course it's reductionist to say that my enemy is my friend, but of course it is fascinating that the deep state appears to hate the Trump administration with absolute burning passion.
And it's the same with
and
the media.
I think that's pretty interesting.
Anybody the
well, they're the same thing. I classify them as the same thing. I mean, the media is just a sort of the part of the deep state that surfaces, you know.
But it's the liberal media.
I was reading this article, I can pull it up really quick, by this Australian environmentalist.
John Pilger.
Oh, yeah, that's the one. He was saying, I think he's a Marxist, but he was flirting with the idea as environmentalists should form an alliance with the populist right. Obviously, exactly. Trump's record on the environment is not so great, if you look at who he's appointed to the EPA. But
I would agree
a lot
with
of
you
the
there.
Issues he touches upon, like the Trans-Pacific partnership, breaking up neoliberalism, outsourcing, mass immigration, all these issues relate to the environment. So even though his public record on the environment may seem obviously not so great, I think there is something to be said about what this writer was saying about an alliance between environmentalism and the populist right.
I think it's important to recognize in these kind of discussions that what a political administration, what a president or people in the part of that administration may or may not want to do is almost really quite secondary to the fact that they will not be allowed to make change. Change is almost impossible, I would argue, in our political structure, you know, because if anyone tries to change anything, I mean, actually change it, not just change, you know, how it looks, it's optics, but if anyone actually tries to change anything, they generally will be defeated, you know. And I think that's something that wherever you might identify yourself politically, I don't really care. But if anything is to change, then there are these massive institutions which are going to have to be sidelined or destroyed.
Look at this whole thing with Russia. I mean, you know, as far as I was concerned, the left was always a group of people who were sympathetic to Russia. And there was a time when, of course, during McCarthyism, when, you know, when the right would say, oh, if anyone was sympathetic to Russia, or maybe Russia's not so bad, you'd be like, oh, communist, you know, let's shame you, you're blacklisted. Now it's the left doing this, you know, in this near
the whole thing's gone upside down, isn't it? I mean, black is white and white is black. It's actually kind of a palpable madness that has completely taken over the mainstream of society. You know, this Russian thing, it's a hobgoblin. It makes no sense, and there's no evidence for any of it. But still, it is. It's there. I mean, come on, let's just call a spade a spade. It's the CIA. They've cooked up this stuff. I mean, I read that supposed dossier from Christopher Steele. I read the whole thing, the whole 35 pages of it. It was like someone's bad high school report, you know. It was embarrassing. It was just a bunch of cobbled together
bullshit,
you know, third party hearsay, which the guy probably just made up because he needed to get it in on time to meet his deadline to get paid. The thing was embarrassing, and yet this is given credence in the media, and it's given credence in the media because the media is completely corrupt. You know, if any journalist actually read that document, because I read it from start to finish, if any journalist read that document and gave that document any credibility, then they are a moron, you know. But nevertheless, the media runs with the document and its outrageous nonsense claims because the media is completely corrupt and they have an agenda.
And I mean, Snowden, and both Snowden and Julian Assange, they both played a major roles far more than any political activist could have dreamed of.
Yeah, especially Assange, I would argue, you know. And I mean, I think Assange has come out of the last year looking very good in my eyes, you know, because he hasn't just played to the quiet. It would have been very easy for Julian Assange to just leak, you know, the easy documents, the easy point of view, the easy world view. Well, he didn't, because I think he what he saw made it obvious to him that the Clinton machine was a particularly nasty political device, you know, and he's really gone out on a limb to do that. I mean, his traditional kind of supporters have absolutely abandoned him, you know, and to me, that's absolutely courageous.
We started off this show kind of talking about these labels, so David, people would say you're a leftist, and then people would say Richard is this alt-right fascist. But I'm listening to you, and it seems to be like there's pretty much everyone concurs in everything. Like, is there?
Well,
like, where's the
disagreement? I'm just after the truth. I don't care where's a blue hat or a red hat or a green hat or a pink hat. I'm just after the truth. I don't care where it comes from or where it's going. I just want to know the truth of the matter.
I'm the same, really, and I know I'm known as somebody of the alt-right, but, you know, I'm rather left-wing on economics, and I'm a bit of a Marxist in relation to economics, and I'm rather fond of at least kind of a reasonable socialism and supporting the arts, supporting health, supporting education. So I'm not an economic libertarian in any way, shape, or form, and I would consider myself an enemy of economic libertarianism and laissez-faire kind of Milton Friedman Jewish bullshit in relation to the economy. So, you know, I'm definitely a person of the left economy, I would even go as far to say. So, you know, again, I'm interested in the truth. I'm also interested in the two ideas morphing together. And I guess that's probably why David and I having these discussions over the years have been so fruitful, because we've been able to throw ideas back and forward. And, you know, and actually because we're not cutting each other off, we're not having a go at each other because we're friends, you know, you're able to see how these things can grow into a kind of, I guess, a synthesis. You know what I mean? Where these ideas...
I completely agree. And I think the kernel here for any of us to go forward versus a society to get anywhere is that there has to be the atmosphere where discussion is possible, where people can hold what appear to be contrary opinions, and they will not be shouted down, and they will not be censored. And I completely 120% disagree with the atmosphere that we presently have of censorship around any kind of political discussion. I completely hold the opposite point of view. I'm opposed to any sort of censorship around political discussion whatsoever.
What do you think of Milo?
I always think you're better off knowing where people stand, even if you disagree with them. You're better off knowing where they actually stand.
The whole Berkeley riot. Remember Milo Yiannopoulos and the Berkeley riot? And the Bill Maher show, and he got he got kind of like, you know, kind of like thrown to the wolves a bit over some controversial comment. Did you follow that at all on media?
Well, my assumption is he got completely deep stated, and actually my assumption is that the CIA or whoever it is in the deep state, whatever name you want to give to that body, has a list. They're trying, you know, for whatever reasons, they're trying to white ant, you know, that part of politics. Obviously, it's seen as a threat to them, and they're going down their list and just, you know, deep stating people. I mean, it's basically one every week or two. Actually, it's fairly obvious. You know, it's not even subtle or clever, you know. And look, I'm completely opposed to censorship, to shutting people down, you know. And, my personal view of what happened to Milo was, you know, I thought it was really quite nasty and really unfortunate, you know. And I think he's a funny guy and he's a charming guy and he's provocative, actually. And we need more provocateurs in our political discourse, not less.
And I think it was a huge mistake of him to apologize. He's been successful like Trump because he didn't apologize. He should have said, I basically said what I said. I stand by it. And basically, you should tell everyone to suck it.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, maybe. I mean, but, you know, he was put in a very difficult position. You know, look, I don't agree with everything the guy says, you know, but that's completely fine. I don't have a problem with that at all, you know. And I mean, as he, you know, he identifies himself as a survivor, a victim of you know, child abuse, you know. Well, that puts him in a very confusing and difficult position. And I think, I'm kind of horrified that he wasn't given the room to work through his own opinions about that. Whether you agree with them or not, surely you should cut someone a bit of room who's been in the, you know, really tragic situation of having that done to them, to work through their own perhaps confused emotions and ideas about it before you pour petrol on them and set them on fire.
Well, that's the whole political climate, is it's gotten to the point where if someone holds certain taboo views, it's okay to basically kind of write them off and totally delegitimize their ideas. Or do you legitimize them as a person as well?
Yeah, it sure looks that way. And it's not only is it ugly and anti-intellectual, it's dishonest, and it can only create a situation where it drives ideas underground, it drives people underground, and it sort of erodes actually the sort of foundations of civilization, really, which is the idea, possibly not the practice, but the idea that you can exchange ideas with people that you disagree with while not setting them on fire.
Would you say that there is any major issues where you and Richard do disagree? Because it seems to be there's pretty much a strong concurrence going on. Concurrence.
There's areas of nuance where we kind of disagree. You know, I mean, I don't want to put words into Richard's mouth. You know, but, you know, I think it's one of these areas where it's really unfortunate where you can't have a civilized discussion anymore is immigration. I think there's definitely room there to have discussions about that, you know. And one of the things, I guess, and I'm not an expert on this, but there's a couple of things that I have questions about the alt-right, you know. And one of them would be, and this doesn't apply to everybody, I'm sure, it's just a general view, is the demonization of Muslims, whereas my view is that, you know, the Muslim world has been used as a pawn in this sort of nasty geopolitical chessboard, you know, and I don't think there's much to be gained by demonizing individual Muslims for that, but, you know, I do see that there is a nasty game of chess going on, you know.
It's interesting how kind of this whole geopolitical politics plays out. And I think now you have the whole migrant invasion going on in Europe. And then there's a lot more anti-Muslim and anti-Arab sentiment. So it's interesting how these kind of political dichotomies within the same movement and a lot of the same people I've been following change. But I think you touched on something important. And a lot of these political intellectuals, like people like Pat Buchanan, especially, and writers like Steve Saylor, they talk about this kind of concept called invade the world, invite the world. And that kind of addresses that issue you were bringing up about the Muslim world.
I think that
yeah, I mean, I just wish that we could, as you know, different points of view could be expressed in this area without people having to shout each other down. And I think in my potted and vague view, and I'm not an expert on the alt-right at all, but in my vague view, and there's very good things about the alt-right, I think, in my view. You know, there's energy there, there's honesty there, there's, you know, provocativeness, you know, as I said earlier, which I think is great, you know. You know, there's a bit of an absence from what I can see, but I'm not an expert, of dissection of the role of corporations in the political sphere. You know, there seems to be a lot of cheerleading of capitalism, which in theory is okay, but okay with me, I guess, in theory, but capitalism has kind of become synonymous with corporate capitalism, which I think is one of the greatest threats that humanity faces, actually.
No, I'd like to make a comment on that in the whole kind of, I guess, what you call the Muslim nexus or the whole nexus of ideas that surround the, I guess, you know, obviously there is a lot of anti-Muslim and anti, could be even called Islamophobic discussion that comes out of the alt-right. First of all, I'd like to say that I totally agree with David that it is a product of this geopolitical chess game that's been going on. And I do think that after September 11, that basically the Western Christian world has been thrown into a war, essentially, with the Muslim world, almost as a whole. I mean, even though it's not admitted publicly, obviously there are countries like Indonesia where there's hardly any trouble, you know, or whatever, but so it's only certain parts of the Middle East that say that, or the Muslim world. But there's definitely been a movement to throw the West, whether it be Christian or secular, against the Muslim world. And I absolutely see that as a situation that has been manipulated by a certain other group of people who I won't name, but let's just call them the globalists. And let's just say, you know,
you just named them.
Well, you know what I mean. The globalists, you know, parts of the state can be part of, you know, maybe the Jewish community, and it can be part of maybe, I don't know, other wealthy plutocrats, whether they be Chinese or Russian or whatever. So let's just say that. And I think that has definitely happened. But I do think that maybe even though we are in this kind of war or at least a strategy of tension type situation, to me, at least as someone who I guess at least partly identifies with the alt-right, some of this animosity, even though it might have started as fake, has become real to a certain extent when you have mass migrations beginning to, you know, it really affects communities in Germany and Sweden where there are no-go areas, where you see rape being used as a weapon against Western people. And that I think at least some kind of temporary halt to immigration from the Muslim world is something that can be considered and blah, blah, blah. And I do so think, and I agree, there's another point I wanted to agree with David on, is that the point, and this plays into what I said before against how I'm opposed to laissez-faire capitalism, because I think that this does play a role, and these corporations do play a role in this kind of tension, oddly enough. And it's never, that kind of connection is never often made, particularly within the alt-right, where I guess with laissez-faire capitalism, Milton Friedman kind of economics, libertarian economics is often accepted. And I think we need to question more the role that this plays in the kind of tensions that are created within, because basically all these fights within, you know, poor Muslims, poor white people in Europe, poor white people in America, and the black community in America, and poor Mexicans who are being deported. This is all about poor people. And, you know, this is not a problem that's affecting the you know, the upper class or the, you know, 1% or even the 0.001%, who are the ones who really control everything. It's not everybody.
It's the same war as always, isn't it, really? It's just got different... It's got different costumes and it's got different scenery, but the same war that I'm seeing, and I've seen it for many, many years, you know, my entire lifetime really, and it's the rich at war against the poor, you know.
It is, and that's, I think, the
this
right
is the same war, and you just dress it up differently, and the media wants to distract everyone from this core question always. But that, this is what, to me, is the war.
And then both sides kind of play off each other. Like, you were talking about the immigration issue. So then the leftists will say to the conservative that we need to let these people in because they're being exploited by capitalism and fleeing war, and that's half true. And then the conservatives will talk about the effects that immigration is having in a negative way in their country. So they're both putting out these kind of half-truths. But the problem is,
meanwhile, nobody wants to address the elephant in the lounge room, which is maybe we shouldn't be bombing 7 countries in 8 years. Maybe a lot of these problems would vanish overnight if the West wasn't dedicated to this perpetual war scenario.
I totally agree with that, and I think that's the important
which
thing.
Which is invisible, isn't it? I mean, who discusses this?
Nobody. The alt-right does not critique that enough. It does not critique the endless state of war that we've been in since September 11. I mean, obviously, this is why Arab people are upset, same as we would be if we were under attack in such a way. So I think the way that we talk about, for example, on the alt-right, we talk about the left being, cucked out, the word cucked, you know, by, like, say, cultural Marxism. But I think that the right and the alt-right itself is cucked out by libertarian economics, which basically plays into the hand of only the very smallest percentage of the mega elite. You know, the upper, you know, the billionaire class and above, you know, and we all know who that is. And, you know, it's quite scary, I think, you know, and I think, you know.
Well, I mean, our whole media and our whole social discourse, I think really actually it is the billionaires discussion. You know, everything you see in the mainstream media, and a lot of the alternative media too, it has to be said, is information and opinions that would be very, very comfortable to the billionaires club, you know?
And who's to take it to be the rebel? A billionaire himself. One rebel billionaire to come along and to upset the apple cart, you know, because maybe nobody else could. Nobody else could actually access the levels of power. Only somebody who could, you know, like go independently and do their own research and, you know, fund themselves to at least partly to a certain extent and build up their own media profile. So,
it's a fascinating scenario, and you know, it's got all these great echoes of Mr. Smith goes to Washington and all those kind of things, you know. And look, I think it's a fascinating scenario. I don't know if it's the case or not completely, but as I argued earlier on, even if there was somebody who wanted to take a broom to this mildew, mold-infected cupboard, which is our political system, there'd be so much pushback against them that they quite possibly wouldn't be able to actually do that, to clean house.
People put up these labels like the alt-right. I mean, we're the ones speaking the truth, and I guess that makes us like the left wing of the alt-right.
Well, I thought, Robert, you're going to bring up alt-left. I mean, that would seem like left-wing faction of the alt-right, or at least people on the alt-right that don't like the Hitler fetishization or, like, the whole, like, you know, if you're into Def and June and stuff like that and you just want to be, like, an avant-garde kind of guy, so you say you're, like, left-wing of alt-right. I guess that's an alt-left that's kind of forming.
I do agree that we need a whole new political landscape, actually. I think all the old labels are irrelevant and actually deceptive, and so I welcome a whole new political landscape. And I think part of that landscape for it to be at all successful is that all opinions can be heard, and all points of view can be heard, and no one is to be shouted down or necklaced.
And it's important to be able to talk to people who have different points of view, whether they're, it doesn't matter if they're a libertarian.
Yeah, and I think the internet is terrible for this. I think it's terrible for being exposed to reasonable points of view, because one of the factors that occurs, and it's obvious, you know, when you have a discussion with somebody in actually the public realm, you know, in the physical world, not online, is that there's all these factors of body language and, you know, non-verbal signals that make it possible to have conversations with people that you don't particularly agree with. I mean, I have conversations with people that I don't particularly agree with all the time, because most people, I don't particularly agree with them, you know. But, it, you know, there is this sort of mitigating element in having physical conversations with people where, you know, there's a greater exchange, I think. You know, this is one of the pitfalls of the online world, is that there's none of these non-verbal cues, and therefore neither side can really nudge themselves into the sphere of the other, so they don't really actually have an exchange of ideas.
I don't think you should always get so hung up with labels, and obviously, you know, you see the labels beginning. Obviously, when the alt-right began to appear, I liked it because, again, it was, as you mentioned, Robert, it spoke the truth. It was a bit rebellious, and it was certainly rebelling against the kind of left liberal, order which had become mainstream. And then I guess that there began to be variations within the alt-right itself. There began to be more the more extreme end, which was like the white nationalist end of, say, someone like Richard Spencer. Then there was more like the middle end of the alt-right. Then maybe there was the alt-light, which is someone like Gavin McInnes, maybe Milo.
I'm convinced that Spencer is a mole, a plant.
Really?
Well, I'm convinced of it.
How
does this person that I'd never heard of before, how does he keep kind of putting his foot in it and kind of sinking his side, quote unquote? The guy's obviously a plant.
I might have to agree with that. I don't know.
I mean, every time he's visible, every time the guy surfaces, he's shooting himself and his team, quote unquote, in the foot. That's a mole.
I think you're right. There's a lot of points about Spencer's backings.
And I'm sure there are others, too. I mean, come on, you know, I mean, there's that great quote from the head of, I think it was the head of MI5 or something from years ago, you know, and he was talking about grassroots political, groups in the UK. And he said proudly, and I'm paraphrasing here, you know, but he said, look, every grassroots political movement in the UK, our man is either the captain or the vice captain. You know, he said words to that effect, you know. Yeah. And so, these groups everywhere are infiltrated and they are distracted and they are, watered down.
Well, that's a very interesting point, I think, David. And I think, it might bear some...
And I mean, if you want to identify obvious contenders, I would hold up Richard Spencer as an obvious contender for that classification.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, some have even suggested Milo as well, obviously, in relation to various things. But, that is possible. I mean, I think one should always keep an open mind. But then what I was trying to say before is there's all this talk of, like, the alt-left as well, whatever the hell that is, which is always, again, open for debate. But the whole point is that, there is a rebellious discourse that's grown, and it's not something like the neocons. It's not something that's happened in the back rooms of Washington, even though we have sort of our man of the alt-right within the Trump administration with Steve Bannon. He seems a most interesting fellow. If you watch his speeches online, I recommend everybody do that. He seems an interesting character who doesn't appear...
He's interesting, isn't he? He's a very interesting guy, yeah.
He's a very interesting guy. So there you go. That's from David Thrussell. Steve Bannon is an interesting guy.
He's a very interesting guy, yeah. Yeah.
So it's good. There is some real change here. You know, and as I said, the full extent to which the Trump revolution and even Steve Bannon, what he'll be able to do within, but the fact that these people are in the White House, this is a real change of affairs. And obviously it was not what was meant to happen. You know what I mean? If you look at what happened...
putting it lightly.
Yeah, you look at Hillary on, like the beginning of the election. I mean, sorry, on the day of the election, she was almost in celebration mode. Like she was convinced she'd won. And so had...
They were sure they had it sewn up. It was so obvious, wasn't it? Obvious they had it sewn up. And they'd convinced me. I mean, my view was always, and I've said this to you, Richard, was that the election was going to be completely rigged.
Yes.
And that's why I always sort of slightly struggled to take it seriously, because I thought that the Clinton machine would completely have it rigged and completely sewn up. They didn't manage it.
It wasn't rigged enough. Trump had such a landslide that whatever rigging, which is probably 6 million votes, whatever rigging they had in place was not enough. You know what I mean? And that's how it all fucked up for them.
I was happy. I was so happy Trump won, actually. Just...
David, your music is copyright-free. Can you talk about that and the significance of copyright monopolies in music?
Well, where that came from was a friend of mine, Uwe Schmidt. Where that began, he calls himself, he started off calling himself Atom Heart or Atom Trademark.
I'm a huge fan of Atom.
Little coconut.
Since I was like 13. I love him.
Oh, okay, yeah, he's an old friend of mine, and that came from him, and that where that began was it was an attempt to not be hypocritical, which I think is always a good thing to attempt to not to be, we recognized that we sampled a lot of sounds from various recordings all over the place, commercially released recordings and record CDs and blah, blah, whatever. We did a lot of sampling. And so we felt it was only right and proper and not at all hypocritical to open up our music to other people to sample, you know, and that they were free to sample whatever they like from our records, you know, which they are and always have been, without any fear of any repercussions, because for us to hold any other position would be completely hypocritical, of course, you know. Don't misunderstand that, though, that doesn't mean that I've encouraged people to pirate other people's recordings, necessarily.
What are some of your upcoming projects? Can you talk about that?
Well, I've got a new band with a friend of mine, Tony. It's called Crisis Actor, and we have a new single. It's just been out a couple of days, actually. It's called Electronic Eye, and we have an album from Crisis Actor called Slave New World, which is coming out in April. You know, recently we've had some new Snog records. We obviously had a Snog tour of the US last year. And, you know, there's different things brewing away. But right now, yes, the new Crisis Actor record is sort of the latest thing off the treadmill. And I think actually all of you would find some of the lyrics on that album, which is coming up in April, quite interesting. There's a couple of songs. In fact, Tony told me not to write any more lyrics that touched on Pizzagate, because there's three on the album that touched on it already. And he said, that's enough. I don't want to hear any more about Pizzagate.
Yes, and
which is the thing that I find it fascinating in the darkest way possible. I think it's you know, if there's truth to it, and historically it would appear that there would have to be at least some truth to it, it's a horrific, dark, the blackest kind of black magic, I would suggest.
Yes, I agree with you, David. You know, and this is a very, very tricky topic, but it appears to be a topic that has some truth behind it. But like, I would like to talk maybe.
There's a lot of smoke there, isn't there? There's a lot of smoke.
There's a lot of smoke. Too much. Yeah, it's the kind of topic too that if you're an investigative journalist in looking into it in the US, it's the kind of thing you'd have a big accident. You know, and
yes, you'd want to make sure you'd updated your will lately. That's
your health insurance. And, you know, one thing I wanted you to touch on is tell people about Omni Recording Corporation, where you've been releasing. Some of these albums I think would be very interesting to many people, like the Hillbillies in Hell, and this is like a classic re-release label that's nearly...
Yeah, look, it's my boutique record label. It started completely off as a hobby, just to sort of, excavate the music that I really love. I'm a closet fan of your American hillbilly music and your country music, and I have been for many, 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 many years, and
it's
I've collected
right
that kind
wing.
Of music.
It's often right wing, it's got to be said, doesn't it? It's often right wing.
Well, there's a spread of opinions, which I always appreciate, but my position on that is, I always enjoy hearing somebody articulate their views and their political views and their political persuasions well and interestingly, even if I don't always agree with them. I'm always interested to see those things encapsulated in song and art. I think that's a really, really valuable thing for us as a society and for history, you know. So I have, you know, it started off as a hobby, but, you know, we've been busy. We've put out a lot of records, you know. As Richard said, we've done a series called Hillbillies in Hell, which is just full of all sorts of, you know, great sort of 50s and 60s predominantly hillbilly songs about all sorts of topics that touch on Satan and damnation and all sorts of, you know, terrible situations and drug abuse and blah, 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 and the sort of, you know, the role of terrible things that happen to people or that people make happen to themselves. We also did a great record near the end of the year, last year, called The Ballad of JFK, which was mostly... Yes. Hillbilly songs about the John F. Kennedy assassination. They're original ones, not any recent nonsense. You know, it was all original hillbilly songs, mostly hillbilly songs, about the Kennedy assassination from the 60s. A lot of them from some of them from weeks after the assassination, actually.
That's extraordinary.
But most of them from 1964 and 1965. We also did a record called Freedom is a Hammer.
Yes,
which
that.
Was a great fun record to put together, and that was all conservative folk music of the 1960s, and it was kind of like the backlash music to your Bob Dylans and your Phil Oakes and these sort of characters in it, and it featured an artist who I've been a fan of for many, many years called Janet Green, who was her backers described her as the anti-Baez. you know, the Wrights answer to Joan Baez. And she wrote lots of strident folk songs about the communist threat and the communism as termites and blah, 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 and all these sorts of things. And look, it's a fascinating record, and we actually got enormous press coverage in the US for that record, you know.
I would really recommend that.
We got reviews on Fox and Washington Times and blah, 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 and all this sort of stuff. So, yes, that's a thing that's something I moonlight doing as well, is excavating in sort of Indiana Jones style, you know, drawing the cobwebs aside in some of these forgotten music vaults and shining a light on all these sort of forgotten areas of culture that I personally find really interesting.
Which film of Richard's did you work on?
There's been a couple, actually. Yes. I've contributed music to, I guess, Tricky Dicky, 3 or 4 of them or something.
I can fill you in. David contributed music to Pearls Before Swine, and he also had a brief role in it. He played the bookseller with Boyd Rice at the Polyester Books. David did a lot of the soundtrack to The Beautiful and Damned. He provided music.
Wait, was that the scene where he was buying the manifesto, or the book on sadomasochism?
I think the book Pure, the manifesto.
Oh yeah, I remember that scene.
And that's David.
That was the scene. I'll have to watch it again.
Yeah, in one of our classic bookstores in Australia called Polyester Books.
And yes, and David supplied the music to some music in Last Days of Joe Blow, and also a few bits and pieces to my new film, The Second Coming. So David and I have been collaborating soundtrack-wise for a long time, but David also has a wonderful reputation as a soundtrack composer. He did the film The Hard Word with Guy Pearce, and he's done a couple of other films. What are some of the other films you've done? Thunderstruck, is that right?
Yeah, a couple of others, Under the Radar, and a few others here and there, you know, yeah, various things. Yes, I tend to bounce around doing different things. I have a wide spread of interests.
Indeed. So, yeah, that Freedom is a Hammer, too. Just let me say that, really, everyone on the alt-right, go get Freedom is a Hammer. Google that, and you'll absolutely love it. It's a complete classic. It's just got about, I don't know, 30 or 40 tracks of classic kind of like 60s kind of right-wing folk music, which is just really, really fun and great to play at liberal, you know, dinner parties.
Absolutely. Great listening on Christmas Day with the family gathered around, you know.
You should talk about it.
I mean, my position on that stuff is, you know, I feel very anthropological about music. I feel that music has all sorts of interesting things to say about society and where society is at particular times and where it might be in, you know, in the past and in the future, you know. And what I loved about Freedom is a Hammer is I might not always agree with some of the opinions that are being expressed, but I really admired their pluck for going against the sort of mainstream and the sort of tide of consensus opinion, you know. And I love tracking down all those old naysayers and flushing them out of the woodwork and talking to them and et cetera, et cetera. It was great fun.
We are at the end of the show. I would like to thank David Thressel for being on. It's been an excellent show. We covered a lot of interesting topics.
Great chatting. It's really good.
My pleasure. Thank you.